This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Deborah Bell.
J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
I'll soon he forget.
We've also got some other folks in the studio.
Yeah,
introduce
we
yourselves.
Have.
Brian Levinka.
And Brian Erickson.
There we go.
Our new interns.
What? Oh, okay.
I'll soon he forgets.
Yes, I know. Well, you have to remind me of these things, of course.
Tell us who's going to be on the show, Jack.
No. Okay. We'll be opening with a women's poetry jam with Donna Garrett, Shirley Bassey, and Saja. And making the holidays happy and gay. Jack Valinsky talks with what?
Wrong one.
Which one did you want me to read?
Oh, the one for tonight?
I think we'll just cut that. And we'll just...
That's the one you gave me.
I gave you several things.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. We're well organized here tonight.
We are. Well, that's what happens sometimes. Okay, tonight we're going to have...
Yes.
We're going to have the lovely Kelly Bennett with the Bayou City Performing Arts, and she's going to talk about the concert that's coming up on the 18th, Ho 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 Down to Hollywood, and that features the Gay Men's Chorus and the Women's City... Bayou City Women's Chorus.
And the Bayou City Chorale.
Which is?
The combination.
Uh-huh. And we'll also have Mara Kessling with the National Center for Transgender Equality, who's going to discuss the employment discrimination.
Non-discrimination. No, we already have the employment discrimination now.
Okay, but we're going to get the Non-Discrimination Act with Miss Jennifer Renee. And then Rich Ehrenschild will be here to discuss a controversial new model in medical product practice called concierge care with Jack Valinsky. And they will talk about what this means for our community. And then later we'll have political dialogue, results of the runoffs, and what's new with the Stonewall Democrats.
And music, Christmas, and otherwise.
And I think we're going to start with that. We got to get out of this somehow, right?
Right.
Save us.
Celebrate, 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 celeb
Hallelujah. All right, that's from the Bayou City Women's Chorus. That's off their new CD. And what's the title of that, Kelly?
Uncommon Reflections.
Okay, and that was during last year's holiday concert.
It's a compilation of all our music. It's our debut CD as a women's choir, so it's kind of exciting. It's the first one we put out.
Okay, Kelly Bennett is with the Bayou City Performing Arts Organization, and her partner Colleen Fisher is the general manager, and usually Colleen is here and brings other folks on, but as it is to happen every now and then, Colleen has put her back out. I hope she had fun doing whatever it was that put it out.
Oh, well.
And so Kelly's here to pitch it and talk about this very exciting holiday show. This is primarily the Gay Men's Chorus, right?
Actually, no. This is going to be a holiday show with the Bayou City Chorale, and we debuted with our Sing for the Cure concert in October.
Right.
So it's going to be kind of one third men, one third women, and one third everybody. So it's going to be a cool combination of all of us.
Uh huh. And do you know the figures on how much money was raised for Susan G. Komen from
$10,000?
$10,000 for Sing for the Cure. That was wonderful. It was a fantastic concert.
Thank you.
And so this one, which has a rather unusual title, Ho, 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 we get, it's Christmas, and Ho Down, I don't know where that comes in, and then Hollywood.
Well, the women's music is based around movie. A lot of the songs are from films, and so it's based on Hollywood and the tie to films there. The men's show is, they got songs like Hard Candy Christmas, and it's a lot of country-themed music and that sort of stuff. So there you go with the hoedown.
And where does this event take place?
It's going to be at Jones Hall on Tuesday, December 18th at 7:30.
And there is a phone number?
Yes. Tickets are available if you go to the website. For one, you can buy them on the website, which is www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org. And the phone number where you can call in is also 713-521-7464, and you can call in too and ask any questions that you have about seats and that sort of stuff.
Now, is this the beginning of a season or the end of a season?
It's usually the beginning. Since we had the Komen concert, it's kind of smack dab in the middle, but we have this Christmas concert, and then this spring we're going to be doing the men are going to be doing a concert called Metamorphosis. And the women will be doing a concert that's based on 40s music. So it's a lot of Rosie the Riveter kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Were they going to have those jackhammer?
I'm sure we'll have some sort of exciting props. We're known for our choreography.
Yeah. It's really fun. And pretty much fills Jones Hall.
We usually get pretty close.
Yeah.
So it's exciting.
And, of course, there's season tickets available. How many concerts will there be altogether?
Altogether, if you were to get the season ticket now, you would have the Christmas concert, and then the two concerts afterwards in the springtime. I believe one's in the April area and one's in May. So it kind of spreads you out through the entire year.
Tell us a little bit about this new CD that the Women's Chorus has done. We just heard that one selection. What kind of other music is on there?
Oh, it's a little bit of everything. It's a great compilation. It's live recordings that we do during our concerts. There's some pieces from a selection we did called Only Human this last spring, which is really inspirational. It's women's stories that were put to song in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
which was really wonderful to sing. And then there's a lot of just fun music, like Girls Just Want to Have Fun and Natural
Theme Song.
Natural Woman by Aretha Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
And just some just fun stuff to listen to. It's a great, great CD for all different times.
And have you been with the chorus since its inception?
I actually joined when Colleen became the general manager last year, but I've just loved it.
She says, okay, I got this job, you have to sing.
No, it was I didn't actually know about them, but the opportunities, we have open auditions, and, you know, if you're willing to put in the work, we're willing to have you sing with us. So we do auditions in August and in January. So we have one coming up for the new concert cycle. And we're also going to do something exciting this summer. In July, we're going to Gala, which is a gay and lesbian chorus convention in Miami.
All right.
And we'll be debuting there as a women's choir at the Gala conference.
Now, is that a competition?
No, it's just a gathering of choirs that we get together and we sing together. So it's...
There was a documentary made called Why We Sing that's about Gala, and one of the previous ones, and I think it was one that held in Canada.
Mm-hmm. They've been all over the place. It's
and there's gay and lesbian choruses all over the world.
There is. I don't know the number, but I believe it's around 100 to 150 choirs that show up. So it's a big group, and there's a new performance hall down there in Miami that we're going to get to sing in, which is really exciting. So
so when is the next audition time?
January.
So if you want to be in on going to Miami and singing, what kind of level of expertise do you need to be in the chorus?
You just really need to love music and be willing to put the work in.
You have to be able to carry a tune.
That helps. Okay. That helps. But some people who think they can't carry a tune actually can. They just need a little help. So
everybody tells me that. But then they hear me and they go, never mind. Just keep lip syncing, which I do very well, thank you. And so, is there any surprises in this concert that we can be on the lookout for? Because I know there's always, like you said, the choreography
is what we like to refer to.
Yeah, but there's some kind of dance or some solos.
We have a great solo. We're doing the piece The Rose from the movie The Rose and kind of a Christmas twist on it. That's going to be a really beautiful setup. We have all sorts of props and stuff we're doing for that, but it's going to turn out really beautiful. And then there's a few surprises. There's that, you know, wouldn't be surprised if I spoiled them, unfortunately. But of course the guys will be doing their usual costumes and dancing, and they all look fabulous in high heels, so we look forward to seeing that again.
They look fabulous in high heels, and the women look in pain in
yes,
high heels.
Well, they luckily don't make us do that.
Yeah. I would like to see them try. There'll be some new sopranos in the group.
Definitely.
Yeah. So the Gay Man's Chorus has been around for quite some time now, and then there was a previous women's chorus in Houston, Heart Song, and then they kind of just faded away. And so how long has it been? This is third year for the women's chorus?
We're barely getting into our third year. And it's really exciting because the response, last Christmas we sold out two concerts. We do our separate concerts at Bering Methodist Church and over in here in Montrose, and then we sold out two concerts, and we had to add a third date. So we're getting a great response from the public, and they're getting really excited about our work, which is wonderful.
And they're just really nice, pleasant evenings, and you can, you know, just, it's like, it really feels like family, in the good way. you see everybody you know, and certain ones you get to dress up for, which is fun. And the women and men, they really put their hearts into this, and there's some really fabulous talent.
Yeah, there is. We have some people that really, you have to be really dedicated to it, and that's all we really ask of our singers, is the dedication and the love for the music. And just a note on the women's choir too, it's all inclusive. So we have a little bit of everything, gay, straight, and, you know, otherwise. So everybody's
welcome. Whatever your choice.
Whatever's welcome.
Yeah. during the Sing for the Cure, Deborah Duncan was one of the MCs, mm-hmm. and she kind of blew us all away with...
Oh, she's wonderful, yeah.
Was it Natural Woman she sang?
I Will Survive,
I Will
actually,
Survive.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, Deb!
Yeah, she also, she's just a big note for us. She was instrumental in getting us to the mayor's tree lighting ceremony.
Ah.
And we sang two songs in that, so that was wonderful. That was probably our first television debut that with everybody included, so that was pretty cool.
So the choruses do perform other than just at concerts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we try to get involved in music festivals and just anywhere we can get out there and get noticed and put music out there, because that's what we want to do.
And then... when you come together with the Gay Men's Chorus, it's called the Bayou City Chorale,
mm-hmm.
and you blend your voices. It's a totally different than either of the...
Well, it's just a wonderful sound because you get the whole range. I mean, just, you know, soprano to bass. So it's a fuller sound. It's just hard to describe, but I know I enjoy being in it, you know, just having that complete push of music coming off the stage.
Some of the singers, I mean, it's like I'm sitting there and, you know, I would sell my soul if I had one to be able to sing, just to sing, much less to sing really well. And there are some people that could be professionals that are in these choruses. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, why are they not out there, you know, being a professional singer?
Well, I can't answer that for them, but I know a lot of them have found that sound in the chorus and found that inspiration. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing to hear and to see people, because we have people come in all the time who think, oh, I'll just be in the crowd, and the next thing you know, they're trying out for a solo and they're on the front of the stage putting themselves out there.
Now, how does the music get decided?
That's artistic director James Knapp. He goes through and picks all the music, and you know, concerts like Sing for the Cure were actually put together by the Turtle Creek Chorale
in Dallas.
Mm-hmm. And so they allowed us to sing it, which was a beautiful thing. And the Dallas Women's Choir was where we got some of our music from the last spring concert for the women. So it was really cool. He goes through and he has a real wonderful talent for picking seasonal music that nobody's... I mean, you never believe how many Christmas songs are out there.
And much less how many queer Christmas songs, you know.
Very true.
Right. JD
very
wants
true.
Them to have that element. And
JD was going to do a whole show on Christmas.
I know,
yeah.
On Queer Music Heritage on the 24th.
Christmas show.
Yes. We always have to work those holidays, it
Christmas
seems.
Christmas Eve will
yeah.
be here.
Yes.
Waiting for Santa.
Is that what you're doing? You're waiting for Santa? Okay. Well, you know, giving the gift of taking someone to this concert would be a lovely holiday gift.
Absolutely.
Or the CDs.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there is the Christmas CD that was the Gay Men's Chorus, but these other CDs that are coming out, particularly the women's, what's the title of it?
Uncommon Reflections.
Uncommon Reflections.
And that's the newest one. And then we had a new season live, which was our Christmas CD last season. Mm-hmm. And then there's quite a few other selections as far as CDs go for the Gay Men's Chorus. And they're all available on the website.
Uh-huh. So let's go over the details again. It's Tuesday night.
It's Tuesday night, December 18th at 7:30 at Jones Hall. And if you do forget to buy tickets, don't worry. You can get them at the box office. It opens at 6:30.
Uh-huh.
So please come. Don't be discouraged. Please come see us. And the website is www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org. And the phone number is 713-521-7464.
Well, thank you, Kelly Bennett, for being with us here on Queer Voices. We're going to hear another piece, I think. No, Jack's shaking his head. No.
Aww.
We're going to go to some music, however. So thank you, Kelly. And you are listening to Queer Voices.
That was Kelly Bennett from the Bayou City Performing Arts. And they will be performing at Jones Hall December 18th, which is next Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. For more information, call 713-521-7464 or go to www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org. And the people who are going to be performing is the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston, the Bayou City's Bayou City Women's Chorus, and the two of them together combined as the Bayou City Chorale. And now J.D.
has a couple plugs I want to slip in. Last week, if you heard our show, we had a very fun interview with some folks from Stages representing the show Altar Boys, which just opened last Friday night. Ken McLaughlin, the producing artistic director, was there, and three of the members of the cast. As I say, I saw the show Friday night. It was wonderful. Great singing, great dancing, and it was so funny. I wouldn't have expected so much humor in almost an entire musical. It was well worth, you know, for me to see, well worth for y'all to see. And also this coming Saturday night at Fitzgerald's, not too often we get quality acts touring through Houston, but the Clicks, C-L-I-K-S, is a group that's been getting a lot of acclaim on Logo. The lead singer, Lucas Silveira, gave me a wonderful interview last summer on one of my transgendered shows. This CD is getting lots of good press, and I'd like to share with you their track, their version of Justin Timberlake's Cry Me a River.
My sun, you were my earth, but you didn't know all the ways that I loved you, no, so you took a chance, made other plans, I bet you didn't know your world would come crumbling down, no, you don't have to say what you did. From him, now there's just no chance for you and me. We'll never be, and don't I make you sad about it? Don't you love me? Why did you leave me all alone? You told me you love me when you call me on the phone. Girl, I refuse. You're making me confused with some other guy. Your bridges are burned. Best left unsaid. It wasn't like you. Only talk to him and you know it. Don't act like you don't know it. All of these things people tell me keep messing with my head. You should have picked honesty and you may not have blown it. You don't have to say what you did. I already know. I found out from him. Now there's just no chance for you and me. We'll never be, and don't make it sad about it. You told me you love me. Why did you leave me all alone? You told me you love me when you call me on the phone. Oh, girl, I refuse. You're making me confused with some other guy. Your bridges are burned. Damage is done, so I guess I'll believe in. The damage is done, so I guess I'll believe in. The damage is done, so I guess I'll believe in. The damage is done, so I guess I'll believe in. You don't have to say what you did. From him, now there's just no chance for you and me. We'll never be, and don't I make it sad about it? You told me you love me. Why did you leave me all alone? You told me you love me. When
is Queer Voices.
We're here today to release the new Department of Defense regulations on homosexual conduct in the armed forces. Don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue.
Sexual orientation is an attraction to a person of a particular gender.
And that's okay as long as you have no desire or likelihood to act on that.
And the White House was permitted to preserve its political capital for other fights.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Brazilians praise a precedent-setting presidential conference. An Iranian execution contravenes its top judge's order, and the lingering smell of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending December 8th, 2007. As 2007 draws to a close, Brazilian LGBT activists have a historic event to look forward to in the new year. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has scheduled a precedent-setting national summit to discuss LGBT civil rights legislation and the prevention of homophobia. The landmark conference was announced in the official Gazette last week and will be held from May 8th to 11th. About 700 people are expected to participate, including representatives from the President's office, cabinet members, legislators, and LGBT organizations. According to media reports, initial conferences will be held in Brazil's 27 states to develop specific proposals and elect delegates to the national gathering. A spokesperson for Lula said that the conference would address the development of a national LGBT human rights plan and evaluate the government's existing Brazil Without Homophobia initiative. Legal recognition of same-gender relationships and proposals to allow gay and lesbian couples to adopt will reportedly also be on the agenda. LGBT civil rights organizer Julian Rodriguez hailed the pending summit, telling reporters that there are countries with more advanced legislation and policies, but this will be the first time that a federal government convenes a complete conference. Homosexual acts are legal in Brazil, and civil union laws have been passed in some regions, but queer activists have been pressing for full civil rights for more than a decade in a country where discrimination and queer bashing remain significant problems.
Elsewhere in Latin America, Venezuelan voters narrowly rejected a referendum on constitutional reforms on December 2nd that would have made the country the first on the continent to protect the civil rights of LGBT people. But new provisions would have also allowed President Hugo Chavez to run for re-election indefinitely and expanded his powers. Opponents worry that passage of the reform package could have paved the way for Chavez's dictatorship.
President Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party won an overwhelming victory in parliamentary elections, also on December 2nd, while more than a dozen gay rights activists were being arrested at a Moscow polling station. The group intended to protest Mayor Yuri Lushkov, a vocal opponent of LGBT rights, who was expected to vote there later that day. A Moscow court dismissed a libel lawsuit filed by queer activists earlier this year against Lushkov for calling LGBT rights marches satanic. Many observers believe Lushkov's hardline homophobia is implicitly supported by the Kremlin. Putin also won a seat in parliament, which would allow him to become Russia's prime minister after he officially leaves the presidency. Several opposition leaders accused his government of rigging the vote.
The combination of an intransigent Republican President George W. Bush and a slim Democratic congressional majority seem to have doomed any queer-positive U.S. legislation from becoming law this year, and possibly even until after next year's November elections. Following weeks of public rancor in the LGBT movement over passage of the transgenderless ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, the Matthew Shepard Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which passed as a standalone bill in the House but only as an amendment to a key defense spending bill in the Senate, was deleted this week prior to a House-Senate Conference Committee charged with reconciling the legislation. The hate crimes measure, named for murdered gay Wyoming student Matthew Shepard, would have expanded existing federal laws, which already cover race and ethnicity, to allow federal prosecution of violent hate crimes based on sexual orientation, gender identity, gender, and disability. It would have also provided grants to help state and local law enforcement agencies prosecute hate crimes of all types, a provision that enjoyed widespread support among police departments across the country. Although the bill explicitly limited enforcement to violent acts, conservative religious groups claimed that preachers could be prosecuted for condemning homosexuality from the pulpit. Senate Democrats had attached the hate crimes amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act because they believed it was the only way to avoid a Bush veto. But about 30 liberal House Democrats reportedly threatened to vote against the combined defense spending and hate crimes measure because they opposed Bush's Iraq war policies, while more than 150 Republican House members opposed any defense spending bill that included the hate crimes amendment. Congressional leaders determined that there weren't enough votes to ensure passage of the combined measures. White House officials have insisted that Bush would have refused to sign a hate crimes inclusive defense spending bill, forcing legislators to drop the amendment from the critical Pentagon spending bill anyway. Judy and Dennis Shepard, Matthew's parents, issued a statement calling the hate crimes defeat a small triumph of process over principle. We are dedicated to redoubling our efforts next year to achieve our vision of a hate-free America that truly includes everyone. If they reach his desk, Bush will almost certainly veto the as-yet-to-be-congressionally-reconciled ENDA and legislation to repeal the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, currently still in committee, but for which there is substantial bipartisan support. Passage of those queer-positive measures, as well as a proposed standalone hate crimes bill in the Senate, may be much more difficult in the coming election year, and any queer-positive legislation may have to wait for a more supportive president and friendlier Congress in 2009.
In other news, despite an order by Iran's chief justice in late November that his conviction and death sentence be reviewed in a new trial, 21-year-old Makhwan Mouloudzadeh was secretly hanged on December 5th at Kermanshah Central Prison for the so-called rape of boys his own age when they were all just 13 years old. Neither his family nor his lawyers were given prior notice of the execution, as required by Iranian law, and only learned about it when prison authorities told them to pick up the body. The young man and all the witnesses against him repeatedly said their statements about the alleged crimes were coerced by the police, and in fact the witnesses recanted their accusations following Makhwan's conviction. The Chief Justice's ruling sent the case to the Special Supervision Bureau of the Iranian Justice Department, a group of judges who are responsible for reviewing flawed cases, he refers to them. However, the judges inexplicably decided to uphold the original court's ruling and ordered that the execution be carried out immediately. Two international treaties to which Iran is a signatory, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, both forbid the imposition of the death penalty for crimes committed before the age of 18. And Iranian law itself bans the execution for sodomy of anyone who was under the age of 15 when the crime was committed. There have been several reports, all denied by Iranian authorities, that this was far from the first execution of a defendant who was underage at the time of his alleged offense. Paula Edelbrick, executive director of IGLHRC, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, which first reported the execution this week, called it a shameful and outrageous travesty of justice. How many more young Iranians have to die before the international community takes action?
Meanwhile, Lesbians, Gays, and Bisexuals of Botswana has announced that it is suing the country's Department of Civil and National Registration because it refused to officially register the group, citing the African nation's laws outlawing male and female homosexual acts. The registrar may deny registration to any local organization, according to local reports, when it appears to him or her that the proposed society's objectives are likely to be used for an unlawful purpose, thus disturbing the country's peace, welfare, and good order. The group's lawyers argue that this matter implicates a whole array of constitutional rights and protections, not least of which are the right to freedom of expression, freedom of association, as well as the right to the equal protection of the law. Lesbians, gays, and bisexuals of Botswana can't legally raise funds unless it is an officially registered organization.
But finally, the sustained popularity of fellow lesbian luminaries like Katie Lang, Melissa Etheridge, and Ellen DeGeneres has probably made it easier for tennis legend Martina Navratilova to get a new job. Health and fitness ambassador for the AARP, the American Association of Retired People, an advocacy group for people over the age of 50. Unlike heterosexual sports stars of her stature, commercial endorsements for Navratilova have been few and far between. Beginning in January, however, she'll encourage AARP's 39 million members to stay active via the group's website, aarpfitness.com, offering health tips and exercise routines that she herself will help develop. According to a press release, Navratilova will also participate in various AARP events throughout the coming year. The 51-year-old tennis star said that, "My goal is to let my generation know that though staying fit takes work, it's just as important now, if not more, than ever before."
That's News Wrap for the week ending December 8th, 2007. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed and healthy community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
It's that time of year again when many of you in the U.S. consider ways to maximize your annual charitable tax deductions. Unlike many other worthwhile causes, we can't survive without your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to get some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives and further reduce your U.S. tax liability. Better us than the government of George W. Bush, right? No matter where you are in the world, we can't go on without you. Log on to thiswayout.org to help keep this program on the air. From the This Way Out family to you and yours, thank you and happy holidays.
For the LGBT community, it was the first big disappointment of the Clinton era. It was 1993, and the newly inaugurated administration announced its intention to fulfill a campaign promise by lifting the ban on gays and lesbians serving openly in the U.S. military. But President Bill Clinton was apparently not prepared for the overwhelming opposition to his proposal from Pentagon brass and congressional leaders on both sides of the aisle. Clinton ultimately agreed to a so-called compromise that became known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue. Queer rights groups have continued to monitor the calamitous consequences of that policy ever since, and more than 60 retired high-ranking military officers, including former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair John Chalikashvili, have endorsed calls to repeal it. A letter to Congress from 28 of them was delivered on November 30th, and a demonstration that weekend honored the thousands of service members who've been discharged under the law. Its ramifications were barely understood in 1993, but as This Way Out reported back then, the new policy itself was barely understood.
You say either, and I say either. You say neither, and I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. You like potato, and I like potato. You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off.
We're here today to release the new Department of Defense regulations on homosexual conduct in the armed forces.
On December 22nd, outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Les Aspin formally announced the Clinton administration's supposedly new policy on lesbians and gays in the military. While the tangle of bureaucratic doublespeak barely veils the new policy's similarity to the old, the administration's dubious holiday greeting reveals much about the homophobia and the political power games that have highlighted the most attention-getting gay and lesbian story in America this year.
These regulations fully implement the Clinton administration's policy that was announced back in July. They are consistent with the Defense Authorization Bill that just recently passed the Congress. And they have been agreed to by the services after a thorough coordination process. The policy, which was announced in July, July 19th to be exact, was don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue. I would wager that not an awful lot of people would have thought that we could pass the Defense Authorization Bill this year without a big fight on gays in the military. We were able to get that piece of legislation through without a big public fight in which it diverted a lot of attention and which required a lot of political capital from the White House. We were able to get it happen in a way in which that we didn't have to divert resources away from other fights on NAFTA, on the economic programs, and all the other things that we needed political capital on this year. So the defense authorization bill was passed, and the White House was permitted to preserve its political capital for other fights.
The services will implement these guidelines, these directives, in 45 days, so that they will become final on February 5th.
Defense Department General Counsel Jamie Gorelick then attempted to clarify some of the specifics of the policy and handled questions from the press.
Now, the statements for which can be a basis for discharge are those that demonstrate a propensity or intent to engage in acts, a likelihood to engage in acts. That is done in the statute as well as in our policy. We've also defined propensity as more than an abstract preference or desire and defined it in terms of a likelihood that the person would act. Again, it's a very conduct-based policy. Now, as you all know, a statement then creates a rebuttable presumption that the person will engage in acts, but the service member then has an opportunity to rebut, and we lay out the kinds of evidence that one might bring in, evidence of one's activities, the context in which the statement was made, the credibility of the person making the statement, the circumstances of the statement. The board then has discretion to assess the facts and determine whether there is that likelihood. Now, if no aggravating circumstances exist and the person is found to be someone who should be separated, they will be separated under honorable conditions. That is, an honorable discharge or a general discharge. That is, without aggravating factors. No inquiry will be made about orientation, but a service member can be asked about conduct if there is credible information, and credible information is information that supports a reasonable inference that there has indeed been homosexual conduct. The commander must assure himself that there is that credible information. Credible information is not rumor, it is not suspicion, it's not opinion. It's facts. Associational activities like going to a gay parade or reading a magazine in and of themselves are not credible information. Only rise to that level if they are such that a reasonable person would believe that the conduct was intended to make a statement, intended to tell other people that the person is a homosexual. The burden of proof remains on the member. The standard is preponderance of the evidence.
But it sounds like I've heard. And I can't understand the word. If he's serious, I can be paid. Oh, sound is all he said.
It seems to me the key to this policy and the purported change is in your assumption that a declaration of homosexual orientation establishes a rebuttable presumption of future homosexual conduct. And given the fact that it's not a major change, isn't this entire policy really the old policy, perhaps more humanely applied in certain circumstances, but basically the old policy in a new suit?
The old policy did not have either the don't ask or don't pursue parts, which I think are very significant and important in allowing someone with a homosexual orientation to, as the Secretary put it, stay off the radar screen. Yes, sir.
Is it still true under this policy that homosexuality is incompatible with military service?
There is no statement to that effect in the directives.
Is that your view, or would you say that it's been altered to say homosexual conduct is incompatible with military?
That is the statement that is in the directive. The basis provision of the directive is basically a quote from the July 19th policy. We understand that to be consistent with the legislation. It does not adopt in the language of the policy. All of the findings of the legislation were, in my view, doesn't need to do so. Yes?
Define, and I know you do so in this, sexual orientation.
Sexual orientation is an attraction to a person of a particular gender.
And that's okay as long as you have no desire or likelihood to act on that?
What we're simply saying is it has never made any difference in the way the military treats a service member. We act on the basis of conduct.
So basically, a homosexual can serve as long as they're celibate.
Again, as I say, it's conduct-based, and we are not looking at anything other than conduct or likelihood to engage in conduct.
There's been some indication in the press and people I've spoken to that some commanders in recent weeks have in fact become, in the words of some gay activists, vindictive and have invoked sodomy prosecutions or threatened to do so. And there's a feeling that they seem to be lashing out on this.
Let me address quite squarely the allegations that have been made in the press in that regard. I want to make two very clear statements. Number one, the suggestion that the criminal process could be invoked against someone who makes a statement is preposterous. There has never been a basis in the Uniform Code of Military Justice for that, nor is there now. Number two, the notion that the current policy that we are about to issue broadens the basis on which someone could be investigated rather than narrowing it is equally preposterous. Yes, sir.
When it becomes clear that the person on active duty is homosexual, then they must separate from the service, even though they have done nothing, somehow you find out. But once it becomes clear, they have to leave. Is that correct?
If it becomes clear that they are homosexual, if they state their homosexuality, they have an opportunity to show that they do not engage in acts, and there would be a fact-finding thereafter. So the question is, do they engage in acts, or are they likely to do so?
Across the Potomac River at the National Press Club, reaction to the Pentagon briefing by representatives from some of the country's largest gay and lesbian political organizations conformed to a uniform code. You'll hear excerpts from remarks by Tanya Domi, Legislative Director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Tim McFeely, Executive Director of the Human Rights Campaign Fund, Karen Johnson, representing the National Organization for Women, and Michelle Beneke, Co-Director of the Service Members Legal Defense Network.
The National Gay and Lesbian Task Force regrets that today's announcement by Secretary Aspin outlining the Department of Defense's new policy on gays and lesbians in the military institutionalizes and accommodates prejudice against gay people. The new regulations are simply a repackaging of the same prejudice and discrimination that existed under the pre-Clinton policy. Gay and lesbian service members continue to live in fear of retribution and reprisal at the hands of a fundamentally flawed policy.
The policy ignores the constitutional precepts of freedom of speech, freedom of association, and equal protection of the laws. Today, the Pentagon announced regulations to implement what, in our view, remains an unconstitutional policy.
We can end discrimination against gays and lesbians in the military with the commitment of leadership and a focus on the behavior of the troops rather than on their attitudes towards gays and lesbians. As a retired military officer with 20 years of service, I am convinced that the military can learn to tolerate gays and lesbians in the military just as they learn to tolerate blacks and women in the military.
Contrary to how the new regulations are being touted by this administration, we don't find them a significant improvement. Rather, we see the new regulations as merely rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. The momentum is building in the courts to find that it's unconstitutional to discriminate against people based merely on fear or irrational prejudice. If anything, the debate over the last year and the new regulations themselves, in our view, merely make it more clear that the policy is founded on nothing more than the irrational fear of other people. Contrary to what the General Counsel for DOD stated during her press conference, the abuses do continue. In fact, my organization has documented continuing instances of witch hunts, of unfair discharge characterizations and court martials with potential imprisonment for gay and lesbian service members stemming from circumstances that are in direct violation of the intent announced by the Commander-in-Chief back on July 19, 1993, in announcing his new policy. The basic advice that we gave to service members under the old policy was to keep their mouth shut and to call civilian counsel. The advice that we will continue to give to service members under this policy is the same, reflecting our view that there's not a substantive difference between the two. Even service members who wish to come out need to speak with experienced civilian counsel before doing so, as there are a number of pitfalls that exist under this new policy. And as a former military commander and officer, as we've sat here talking, I've sat here wondering how this is going to be discussed in the field, because I deal with service members every day who have not been to law school or who have not been immersed in this national debate over the last year, as all of us have been. And I deal with commanders every day who are in that same boat and who are very confused right now.
Among several aspects of the policy that remain unclear, how does one go about proving that future unacceptable conduct will not take place? It will be interesting to see how these new guidelines will be implemented in the field during the next several months to see if there has indeed been a substantial improvement in the lives of lesbians and gay men serving their country in the U.S. Armed Forces. Years and some 12,000 discharges later, Don't Ask, Don't Tell remains a political hot potato. The bipartisan Military Readiness Enhancement Act currently has 137 co-sponsors in the House, but little traction. To light a fire under that effort, several national LGBT organizations, including the Service Members Legal Defense Network, Service Members United, the Human Rights Campaign, Log Cabin Republicans, and Liberty Education Forum, staged a 12,000 Flags for 12,000 Patriots event on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Demonstrators placed a flag on the mall for each gay or lesbian member of the U.S. Armed Forces dismissed under the policy, highlighting the irony of a national security-strained military discharging many badly needed service members simply because of their sexual orientation.
...2007 brought us an astonishing variety of LGBT musicians and musical styles. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Join us as we present some of our favorites on our special 2007 Audiophile Year in Review, the week of December 24th, here on This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Donna Ann Ward, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Christopher Gall and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Thanks also to Mark Torres at the Pacifica Radio Archives. Michael Feinstein, the Rivingtons, and Ray Charles performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please check out the Happy Holidays message at thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. Subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly programs there. Email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Switch 1197 AM, Brisbane, Queensland, WYEP in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, KDHX, St. Louis, Missouri, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Do, do, do. Static is raining on the radio. I am searching for a smile, so I turn the knobs and move along, searching for a tune that makes my heart beat, shakes my spine, makes me move my feet, pick up my pace and hum a song. You are a classic butter keeper, always make me stronger when I'm weaker. Hey now, hey now, my boyfriend's back. Remember riding down the highway, holding your hand as you lean my way. A smile, a whistled melody. Your notes are etched into my brain. It don't matter what else the world sings, I just want perfect harmony. You are a classic butter keeper, boyfriend's back.
Smile by side, I want some of that
good old fashioned doo-doo-doo-wop. You are a classic butter keeper, always make me stronger when I'm weaker. Hey now, hey now, my boyfriend's back.
This is JD. That's called Boyfriend. It's by Ron Morris, a New York area artist who's a friend of mine. He had a wonderful album a couple years ago called Speak True. This is just an EP with several interesting remixes. And coming up next, these guys are fun. Bear Force One, four bears from the Netherlands. They have a song called Christmas Is Here. Go to YouTube to check out the fun video. Christmas Is Here.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
And this is Jennifer Renee, and we have on the phone tonight Mara Kiesling. And Mara is with the National Center for Transgender Equality. Welcome, Mara.
Hey, Jennifer. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. It's been since Atlanta in September's last time I saw you.
Yes.
A lot of things have happened since then, haven't they?
That's for sure.
A whole revolution around the ENDA. The latest ended, and for those of you who don't know, that's the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. So, we've had on the show Joe Simonies, who basically gave us the party line. And there's been a lot of talk. We had a town hall here with HRC at the helm, and on the 18th of this month, you're going to be here, and we're going to have a town hall with you there.
That's correct. I think there's a lot to be said on the topic, and I think people all over the country are anxious to understand a little bit better about what happened and why it happened, and more importantly, what we're all going to do going forward to get it fixed.
Well, tell me a little about, from your perspective, what was happening that we didn't see?
Well, you know, it's something. This is a bill that people have been working on for decades, in some version or another. And this year was the first year that gender identity had been put into the bill. Now, the arrangements to have that done were made last year and in 2005. But this year was the first year we had a bill introduced in the House that included gender identity. And a lot of folks have been doing a lot of education about it, and we came to a point in September where we had the votes to pass the bill, and a lot of people think that they've heard that there weren't the votes to pass the bill, and that's not precisely true. There was very little disagreement that there were the votes to pass the bill. What has been in question is whether or not there were the votes to overcome a particular parliamentary maneuver that the majority leadership was afraid that the minority would introduce, and that might cause the whole bill to collapse if the Republican minority introduced the exact parliamentary procedure called a motion to recommit that they were afraid they might. So ultimately what happened is, based on a hypothetical fear, the majority took gender identity out of the bill. And I think others might not phrase it that way, but that's essentially what I think most people would agree happened.
Well, in many of the pronouncements from HRC actually said that there weren't enough votes to pass it with gender identity and expression in it. When I did the show with Joe Simonies, I had it all printed out from statements that he had made, because
right. As
a member of HRC, I was getting all of the inside talking points, if you will.
That's right. Well, again, if the bill had come up for just a straight vote, there were enough votes to pass it. The question was, if this one particular thing happened, then there, you know, may or may not have been the votes, but there was never even a chance. And basically the majority, as they've been doing on a whole lot of issues, I mean, it is not just trans people who have been hurt over the last few months by this kind of trepidation, there were enough votes if it had just come up regularly, but there was fear that it wouldn't come up straight and that it would lose, and that would hurt it for everybody. But again, one of the arguments that we've been making, and a lot of folks have been making, is there never was a question that this could become law this year anyway. So if the bill that everybody wanted, that everybody's worked so hard for, wasn't going to go into law, and the majority was concerned that one particular maneuver would kill the bill, why not just back off and let, you know, the advocates work to shore up support, even if that one particular parliamentary maneuver were to happen?
Well, and which brings up the question is, where were the manipulations? Why was it so important that a bill of some kind pass this time, no matter what?
That's part of what was most unconscionable about this. Again, almost nobody thought or thinks that this had a chance of becoming law this year. And to rush it through the way it was rushed through really doesn't make sense to very many people at all. And, you know, one of the most ludicrous things here is that somehow this was all about setting it up for 2009 to have an inclusive bill. And I think it's pretty widely accepted that what was done this year makes it much more complicated to have an inclusive bill even introduced in 2009, let alone passed. I don't think anybody will ever be able to justify for me why this had to be jammed through the way it was. It's really unprecedented that Congress would try to pass a civil rights bill that almost the entire community that it was supposed to protect did not want. And remember, even HRC, until early November, was claiming that they didn't want it passed this way. Now, the truth is they were working on it since late September on the non-inclusive bill.
Which brings to question the prognostications of Joel Somanese in numerous venues, one of them being the Southern Comfort Conference, that he was outright lying. I can do that.
It's important for me to be somewhat diplomatic, but I don't know how you could come to any other conclusion, frankly.
Well, and I mean, I was there. I heard what he said. And then his actions are just absolutely the opposite to that. Yeah. And in my interview of him, I quizzed him on that. And, of course, he danced the incredible sidestep.
Yeah.
Now, I understand there was the rumors being that there was a meeting at some point in this early going on, and Intact was part of that meeting. Is that true, that there was HRC and Intact and a few other organizations meeting with Barney Frank or the leadership?
I do not know of a single meeting that would describe.
Okay. Then that was just one of those rumors that came out to bolster that was one of those talking points that had come out. Now, I also understand that there was recently a conference call with HRC. Were you part of that conference call?
I do not know. No, I wasn't, and I'm not sure which call you mean.
Okay, announcement I had recently, Human Rights Campaign had a conference call with certain leaders within the transgender community.
I've heard about that, yes.
So you weren't part of that. You're a leader of the transgender community.
Well, thank you. Our current position at NCTE is that we won't do anything at this point until HRC at least actively stops working against transgender people. We won't do anything to increase HRC's credibility as a spokesperson on trans issues. See, what happened here, if we can get just philosophical and historic for a moment.
Please do.
That was so unconscionable is that HRC is the largest LGBT advocacy organization. And that's great. We should have large organizations and small organizations, but it's good that there was an organization that built up the kind of credibility it built with Congress. And it built up that credibility as a spokesperson for LGB and T people. And what happened this year is they came to a moment where they were asked to make a decision where they stood on an LGBT issue. And either they really believe that they represent trans people, in which case, and we're an actual part of the fabric of their family, and if that's the case, they could, it would have been unthinkable of them to support this bill without us, any more than it would have been possible to support it without the L or the G. So it just would have been unthinkable. On the other hand, if we aren't that integral to their to their family, to their mission, and everything else, then they have no right to speak for us. And to use this historic moment to speak for us, to say that it's okay for us not to be included, is just an incredibly, I don't know what to say other than immoral. I mean, even if you
That's
believe,
a good word. I like that.
Yeah, even if you believe that, even if you're somebody who believes, and there are these people who believe that it is good to go ahead with endo without transgender people, you can't say that and say that you have the right to speak for trans people.
No. Well, and two, not only did they give up or throw the transgenders under the bus, if you will, being one of those being thrown under the bus, the one thing is that in there they took out gender identity or expression. And I have always talked about gender expression as being vitally important to the G and the L.
Right.
Because very rarely does someone fired because they're gay or lesbian. It's because they don't fit a certain stereotype. They appear to be gay, which has everything to do with their gender expression.
That's right.
And Joe Solmanis didn't agree with that, by the way. That my line of thinking there. We've got just a minute or so left, and I wanted to ask you, is there anything you want to make sure that we hear that came out of what went on in Washington that you want everybody to know about?
Well, I think it's important to understand that that some little bits of good came out of this. You know, this whole United ENDA effort that sprung up, I think really speaks well for the future of the movement, the LGBT movement. It was a grassroots moment where tens of thousands of LGBT people around the country came forward and spoke out in ways that they never had before, and in ways that, frankly, the national organizations, including NCTE, my organization, that never asked them to do before. And I think what we saw was there are a lot of LGBT people out there who really want to get involved in federal politics, and are really there for us to say, hey, how do we get involved? And you know, not every one of them, but most of them are very trans supportive and really want to move forward, all of us together. And it, you know, while I think the damage that's been done to us by HRC and others is really pretty severe and historically severe, there is some consolation in knowing that there really are tens of thousands of LGBT people who want to be in the trenches with us and will stay in the trenches with us until we get all this done.
Thank you. That says it all. I want to remind our audience that on December 18th will be a town hall here in Houston at 3400 Montrose. That's second floor. It starts at 6 o'clock. And Mark Easling will be there. And we're going to talk about ENDA in our community. And we'll hear some more from Mara. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much, Jennifer Renee.
This is Jennifer Renee.
See ya.
Well, the air is frozen, the chills my nose, and the moon, it glows through the pines, and the wind is still. And on every windowsill we walk by, there's a candle burning bright, and your cheeks are roses. So do you suppose we should go get cozy back inside? We could hum a song as we let the night roll on towards Christmas. Towards Christmas. And though the streets are quiet, I can hear the sound of snow under our shoes as we walk on. Past all the street lamps and storefronts and the quiet homes where sleeping children dream about the dawn. That's when gifts will be opened, kind words spoken, neighbors and family passing through. They sit back home now, it's late. Tomorrow when we wake, it will be Christmas. So yeah, it will be Christmas. Ah, it will be Christmas. Ah, it will be
Daniel Cartier and Tomorrow Will Be Christmas from his CD, Don We Now, Our Gay Apparel.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, that wasn't the case. I mean, yes, and as well. I don't know if you all saw the movie Owen Michael Moore, talking about insurance, his movie Sicko. The movie was actually interesting because it wasn't about people who didn't have insurance, it was about people who did have insurance. This month's edition of Outsmart, which is another wonderful edition because it's just packed full of very good articles, and they always do a great job over there. Rich Ehrenschild titled an article, When Insurance Is Not Enough. This is something that's sort of coming new to our community. I guess it's been around a little bit. Why don't you give us a little background of what you were writing about?
Well, the background, first of all, thanks very much for having me tonight. I appreciate being here as always. It's good to see you. The background regarding this article came principally because I was a member of a medical practice here in Houston, and I received a letter that the practitioner that I had been seeing and that many of my friends had seen for years was going to a new paradigm of medical care, basically something they call concierge care, where in an effort to increase the quality of care, decrease the number of patients that a physician sees, increase accessibility to physicians, physicians basically, you essentially buy into the practice. And in this particular case...
And now let's be devil's advocate here. We're in a capitalist society. And if somebody wants to purchase something to have better quality, and apparently part of this also is that this doctor would only then have so many patients.
Right. And I mean, everything, we are in a capitalist society, so the people that have the resources get... get the carrots, basically. And what was interesting in this particular situation is that this particular medical practitioner was one of the top HIV specialists in the city. And so in this particular case, this wasn't some orthopedist at some hospital curing broken bones and broken noses. This was a man of truly national renown who was here in town, had been here a long time, has been here a long time, has practiced in Houston probably, I've known him for 15 years. He is among the top, I'd say I'd place him in the top five HIV experienced medical professionals. So for him to trim his practice from 4,000 or 5,000 patients to down to 600, there were a lot of implications there. So this was not kind of an ordinary occurrence, given the small number of HIV practitioners that we have here, given the complexities of treating the disease, given the needs of the patients that see this particular professional. This was kind of a cataclysmic event.
Now, also, with the fact that, you know, this history of HIV has been rather long, there's been a lot of things going on, some people can just pop pills and they're okay.
Right.
Some people who've been surviving a long time, it isn't quite the case because they have a lot of things that don't work for them.
Right. So, as I've said on this program before, a couple things are happening within the epidemic within in Houston, Texas. Number one, you have an increased number of HIV-positive people living longer. You have, and with that increased longevity comes the normal systemic problems that you would see with aging. Hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, osteoporosis, cancer issues, all those kind of things. So you have a population that is aging, you have a population that is growing, you have declining reimbursements from public and private payers regarding insurance, and you have medications that are becoming more and more expensive. In the last year, we've had some very significant moves in terms of treatment, but at very significant price increases as well. So you have this whole chain of events that's occurring, and then on top of that, you have a major practitioner in the city that says, you know what, I want my life back. I've been practicing in this city for 15 years. I've been on call essentially 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I have been beloved by my patients, by other practitioners, by treatment advocates, by individuals in the field, and now it is time for me to reestablish my priorities. And so, as a result, this move to concierge care, this particular practitioner, he isn't the first person to do this in Houston, but he's the first HIV specialist to do so. And that's what caused the difficulty.
And who is picking, are there people picking up the slack?
Well, it's interesting. In preparing for this article, I talked to a lot of different people. I talked to other medical professionals. I talked to patients. I talked to all kinds of people that had an interest in this arena. And the consensus from everyone that I spoke with for this piece was that there is indeed a larger problem here in Houston, in that the pool of HIV-specific experienced practitioners in this town is shrinking. I think that's happening for a couple reasons.
Is that probably also happening all over?
I think so. And the general gist of the information that I got was that Houston is not the only metropolitan area that's dealing with this. I think there's a couple reasons. Number one, HIV is not as lucrative a field because there aren't, just from a financial standpoint, there aren't a lot of procedures that you do on HIV-positive folks that generate revenue. You basically have an office visit or a hospital visit. Those are the two main ways in which physicians interact with patients. Also, I think initially, I started working in HIV in about 1988 or 89, and initially the people that were like me, that were young, that were just out of medical school or just beginning their medical careers.
And what is your background, Rich?
My background is HIV education. I've done a lot of work in HIV training, treatment education here in town. I work with a lot of nonprofit organizations. I work for a hospital here in town, not in an HIV capacity, but I'm involved very much in healthcare and have been for the last 15 years.
And you've been on the show a number of times talking about HIV
right.
and some of the research that has been done, and sometimes over my head.
I hope not.
No, but you try to bring it down to a you know, to a level that we can all understand.
So I think you get back years ago when we were in the middle of the epidemic, as I say, there were a group of medical professionals that were interested in infectious disease, in HIV, who were committed to the cause of medical care in HIV. First of all, because it was such a conundrum. There, every time we turned around, we had a different thing that we were trying to deal with and trying to figure out and trying to discern what was happening. And so, in the early days of the epidemic, there was a core of primarily gay medical professionals that said, something is happening to our community. We must, as medical professionals, address this issue. And they did it through research, they did it through clinical care, they did it through education. So what's happened since then is HIV has ceased to become this kind of lucrative, sexy thing. Now it's a disease that disproportionately affects a very needy population. It's extremely complicated. Fully one-third of the people that are HIV infected are not in care and come to care late, with low T cell counts, with the extreme complications, and the difficulties that a physician must face in dealing with HIV now, when you look at this specialty versus other specialties, you know, why not go work in a dermatology practice and work 9 to 5, you know? So I think there are a number of things that contribute to the shrinking pool of HIV specialists.
And to add to that, I think as you're saying, is that there are a number of people that when they become infected, they're also dealing with a lot of other primary issues.
Exactly. So a lot of these physicians are not, maybe they might not be doing as much clinical care. Maybe they're going into research. Maybe they're working for pharma. Maybe they're seeking more of a cure. Maybe they're working towards that. And as a result, we have an increasingly weary group of docs here in town that are seeing more patients with more problems with less resources. So on one hand, you say, well, you know, how could this physician leave these patients like this? But on the other hand, given the complexities surrounding the disease and the population that it affects, it's perfectly understandable that that would happen.
How is the treatment changing with the demographic of those with HIV? I know that we've heard statistics how the black female population is being decimated with HIV, as well as a whole generation.
Well, certainly minorities are disproportionately affected by HIV, and as I said, some of those folks come to care later on in the disease process, which complicates their care, and it also limits how much physicians can actually do for them, given that their immune systems have really been knocked to the ground by this disease.
Do you think that's due to just denial on their part that they're really sick with HIV?
Well, I think there's the denial is certainly a part of it. I think there's still a lot of internalized shame about HIV. There's a lot of stigma, especially within the minority communities. There's a lot of secrecy there. There's also more basic things like simple lack of access to care. You know, they don't have, a lot of folks don't have a regular medical provider and may experience, symptoms related to HIV infection, and they may think that it's something else, not related.
Are doctors, general doctors in the community, being educated about AIDS and HIV?
Oh, yeah. I think now, you know, the back in the old days...
But they're not specialists, necessarily.
Right. I think the medical community now is much more aware of AIDS in terms of primary HIV infection when a person is initially infected. They're much more aware of opportunistic infections when patients present to emergency rooms. I don't get the sense that that's the issue at all, because I think, contrary to what happened 15 or 20 years ago, now students are, you know, medical school students are more aware of this, more aware of the epidemic and how it presents in different populations.
I have a friend who goes to Thomas Street, and he has nothing but positive remarks about how well Thomas Street, considering, you know, what they're up against. It's a public hospital, that it still is a very good institution.
It's an interesting point you make, and I think the one saving grace is that for those of your listeners who don't know, Thomas Street Health Clinic is the Harris County Hospital District's freestanding HIV clinic, and it is still, I believe, the largest freestanding HIV clinic in America, and that is where all of the residents of Harris County who are uninsured or underinsured receive HIV-specific primary care. The interesting thing about Thomas Street is that even as we have this shrinkage in the community, with doctors going to concierge care, with less doctors coming into infectious disease and HIV, Thomas Street remains a pretty wonderful safety net, in that the physicians there, and if you talk to the director there, Pete Rodriguez, you talk to him, you talk to Thomas Giordano, you talk to Ben Barnett, Roberto Arduino, these folks are among the best clinicians in HIV in the nation, and they are well respected. And I would put the clinicians at Thomas Street up against any clinician anywhere in the country.
And it didn't start out that way.
Well, I think there has always been a strong commitment to the care of HIV-positive folks in the city. Now, remember, when Thomas Street opened, I guess it was probably 15 years ago, don't quote me there, we knew much less about the disease. But what's happened, especially during my time in being familiar with Thomas Street, is that the physicians there are very involved in clinical trials. I know that the SMART study took place there. There are quite a few studies that have taken place from Thomas Street. The physicians there are also professors at UT and Baylor Med Schools, so they have to keep up on kind of the most current happenings in HIV. So even as the private sector in medicine shrinks, we still, it's a bit of an oxymoron that the public sector is actually fairly well funded, and patients who have to access public sector funds, either through Ryan White or through Thomas Street, really do get superb care.
Where do you see this going now? Do we expect other doctors to go to this system where they're going to limit their patients? Is it going to be tougher for people who do have insurance to get good care?
Well, like I say in the article, there's kind of almost a tiered system of medical care versus insurance. At the very bottom of this tier, you have the uninsured who access the public health care system. Then just above them, you have what I call the underinsured, which are people who have insurance, but they have insurance with tremendous copays,
yes, yes, mm-hmm,
and
yes,
with tremendous deductibles. You know, you're okay if you get run over by a bus, but God forbid you get an upper respiratory infection,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm
know. So so you have the underinsured folks. Then you have people that have kind of regular insurance with an 80-20 plan. But even those folks are now facing increasing copays. So before, it used to be that those folks, if you had what was considered regular corporate insurance, mm-hmm, from your employer, you thought of yourself as kind of safe and immune from all kinds of problems. Well, now we have another tier of insured who I call the elite insured, who are the people that walk into the doctor's office, the doctor walks in, they have a 45-minute consultation, the doctor gives them all of their medical history on a disc which they keep in their wallet, the doctor gives them their personal cell phone, which they can call him or her at any time of the day or night. And so I think medical care, access to medical care, is becoming increasingly stratified. And when that kind of stratification happens, usually, in my experience, the people at the bottom, the people in the middle and the bottom of the boat kind of are put out in the drink. So you just, I'm concerned about the fact that that although I understand the reasons for this kind of movement and that really, you know, demand drives this. This particular practice, was, so there were 600 spots in this practice which were subscribed within, I think, 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, I understand that.
At $1,500 per subscription.
Right.
So
Above and beyond insurance. Right, and copays.
So, as usual, the market drives the process. And I will tell you that if I became HIV positive tomorrow, I would mortgage my house to be part of that practice. I would not have a doubt in the world about doing that. And I had a number of friends and colleagues who have done that and are very happy that they did.
Rich Ehrenschild, this wonderful article, you can get it online at OutSmartMagazine.com, but I would really suggest you pick up the current copy of Outsmart Magazine, because besides the wonderful article that's in here that Rich did, there are a number of other good, very good articles that Outsmart always does, and I think we're very lucky that that you are part of this edition of Outsmart. Rich, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
No music, no TV, no Jack, Will, or Grace. The stocking well hung in the bedroom with care. I do hope that Big Nick will find his way there. I wore a bandana, not much more than that. The silence was shattered. I woke from my nap. Oh, such a clatter. Now what was the matter? I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap and kissing and holding his helper so tight. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap. Happy Christmas to you and to all of the night. Quick to the window, I flew like a flash. The treatments were awful, they needed a sash. I gazed at my perfectly manicured lawn, hoping and praying that nothing was wrong. I gasped and I choked as I opened my eyes. Then I looked even closer. Oh, what a surprise! A sleigh in my garden and a dashing young chap sporting a suit that he bought at the Gap while shopping with Daddy, who wasn't a hunk, but a ball of red fur and a little bit plump from eating way too many Twinkies. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap and kissing and holding his helper so tight. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap. Happy Christmas to you and to all of the night. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap and kissing and holding his helper so tight. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap. Happy Christmas. To come in with your herd of big men and sit on my deck and lounge in my den. Bring Dasher and Dancer and Mark, Rick, and John, and a few of the toys for Philip and Ron. I spoke every name, sang each one with care. Then Santa leaned over and said, "Fix your hair." I cut and I curled, I poofed and I sprayed. Then Donnie and Dasher unloaded the sleigh. So you and your boys and your elves and your deer, kick off your Gucci's and have a cold beer. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap and kissing and holding his helper so tight. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap. Happy Christmas to you and to all of the night. Now Santa,
Samantha, you rest, and Mark, come with me. I need your assistance to put up my tree. Now, Philip and Ron, you both mustn't fight, or Santa won't leave you a present tonight. Oh, was it a dream? Did I have a ball? Kissing all Santa's helpers until they were called to load up the sleigh and speed through the night. Happy Christmas to you and to all a good night. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap and kissing and holding his helpers so tight. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap. Happy Christmas to you and to all the night. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap and kissing and holding his helpers so tight. I'm dreaming of sitting on Santa's lap. Happy Christmas to you and to all a good night.
Now, where else would you hear Sitting on Santa's Lap except on Queer Voices? That was Charles Green. Back in those days, this was like 2002, he went by Happy Charles. Well, now he's just going by Charles Green. Sitting on Santa's Lap.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, if you didn't notice it, this past Saturday was an election. Having an election in December is not always the smartest thing. At least the weather was nice. But we have this system here in Texas that if you don't get 50% or more of the votes, there's a runoff. And on municipal elections that happen in November, that means that in December you'll have a runoff. And that generally seems to happen on people who are running for offices that are being vacated because of term limitations or because a person moves on. And if you were watching or listening to the media, you probably wouldn't have seen it either. KTRH decided that the big 50,000-watt AM news station that they call themselves decided that they weren't going to cover the election.
It wasn't newsworthy to them, apparently.
Apparently it wasn't. And, you know, it's interesting. In the old days when you used to go to campaigns and they'd have the TV on or the radio on, and they used to usually have KTRH on. But nowadays you get it directly from the county, the results, because that's where everybody gets it. At least with the Internet you can do that. There were two races that the caucus was very much, the Houston GLBT political caucus was very much involved in, along with the community, and that was a race for District D, which includes Montrose and Southeast Houston, and also an at-large position, Position 5, which, strangely enough, Position 5 is currently held by Markel Berry, who is the operations or program director at Clear Channel AM stations in Houston, which includes KTRH. The person supported by the caucus was Jolanda Jones for Position 5, and she won incredibly handily,
yes,
about 2-1. And Wanda Adams won in District D about
56%.
56. Yes, and it was amazing because I usually get so damn burned out after an election. I go home and watch the results on TV, and
you would have missed them. There weren't any on results.
Well, actually,
10 o'clock there was a little blurb.
Channel 11 at 11 o'clock I was watching, and they're at both
and
campaigns.
And who did you happen to see?
Well, standing right behind the candidates, like in these two separate shots, was Jennifer. She just got right up there, and
were you running back and forth between the party?
Absolutely. That's what I was doing. It was very important to, you know, be there at the, you know, the moment. I was at Jolanda Jones's party until they declared the victory, and which was rather early in the evening. And then as soon as that happened, I moved on over to Wanda Adams' party so that I could be there when they declared the victory, because it appeared that she was going to win anyway. But we didn't know how soon, because it was a little bit closer race. As it turned out, it wasn't that close.
And Jennifer, of course, is the president of the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Political Caucus, and the PAC, the Political mm-hmm. Action Committee of the caucus, had endorsed both those candidates.
Both candidates, yes.
And there's some indication that it was the impact of the caucus's involvement that won these elections for...
Yes, some of the statistics that I've heard, and I can't verify these at this time, but this comes from an authoritative source, is that if you took out the impact of the GLBT community's boxes, which are predominantly in the Montrose area, Jolanda Jones would have won, but by a very close margin, and Wanda Adams would not have.
that our impact in these two elections were phenomenal. We were important in those. Our community reached out and supported those people that support us.
Right. In reality, though, it was an incredibly low turnout, which we expected. In reality, though, our people do turn out maybe a little bit better, but not as much as they should to vote. And well, that's really,
really
sad. We're
still going to get on them about that.
Oh, yes.
We have
another election coming up. There's always an election coming up in Houston.
Yes, this is true. Well, we have with us Teresa Heron, who is, I guess the convener of the Stonewall Democrats in Houston.
Oh, right, and I'm serving as interim president until we elect our officers in January.
And the is it Houston Stonewall Democrats or Stonewall Democrats of Harris County? What is it?
Our name, the Houston Area Stonewall Democrats, because we have supporters and members from the counties close to Houston and to Harris, and so we decided to go with the whole entire area so that we could have a bigger impact.
Right.
And I would like to congratulate the caucus on their work with the runoff, because as an election judge down in the Westbury neighborhood, we had only 36 individuals vote on Saturday, and it was so interesting to watch the alternate judge, a Republican, as in came individuals with the caucus card. And she goes, oh my goodness, and finally about 4:30 in the afternoon, she made a phone call. She says, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, I'm just sitting here, and it's just all lesbian and gays. I mean, you know? And so it was so much fun to see that.
I think that's a little bit of the myth, because there's a lot of progressive people that take that card also.
Well, okay.
This is true.
Right.
Yes.
Well, most of these individuals were coming in pairs, and when they signed in, they were coming from the same address. But
partners,
I'm sure,
yeah.
Right, so exactly.
There you go with that voter ID thing, Jack.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
so.
The important thing is to note that the GLBT community is spread throughout the county.
Oh, definitely.
Right. We're not just, our heart is Montrose, but yet we have moved out to other areas and live there, because I don't live in the Montrose. I live out in the West End.
Yeah, I'm out in the Heights.
Which can help us all the more as we turn Harris County Democratic. And that's what Stonewall is designed to do. And we are fully supportive of the caucus, and we hope to work collaborative with the caucus in many endeavors. In Houston, however, we wanted to go ahead and provide an organization that can work inside the Democratic Party, because as we know, politics, like it or not, is a partisan sport. And it's very important for us to be able to have individuals who are going to be elected to the delegates, perhaps, hopefully, all the way to the national convention this year in Denver, but also to be there to help write the platform and to help make sure that, unlike in 2006 when the Democratic platform of Texas was written, that this time we are mentioned. In 2006, if you read the Democratic platform, they have very nice, vague language to support us, but nothing specific. And that's part of our goals as the Houston area Stonewall Democrats.
So explain exactly what Stonewall Democrats means. There's a national organization.
Yes. We're part of the national organization as well as the state organization. And National Stonewall began approximately 10 years ago as a vehicle to help gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender Democrats have a place that they could have within the party. This year, because of their work over the last decade, each state has pledged to have so many out, open, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender individuals as delegates to the convention. Texas, we're looking to have 12 seats that are basically reserved for our community at the convention. Now, hopefully, ideally, we will have more delegates than that at the national convention, but that has been set aside.
So you could get elected as a delegate and it have nothing to do with your GLBT status.
Oh, certainly. But the state has promised that they will carry 12 individuals from our community to Denver. So we have those seats set aside.
Right. And explain that process a little bit, Teresa, because I don't think people understand that voting is just like the most basic part of the democratic process, that there's this whole other level that starts with the precinct and the precinct caucuses.
Certainly, and that'll be part of what we're educating our community regarding the March 4th primary, and that's the next election, as you guys were alluding to.
Unless you live in Pasadena, there's actually a runoff.
Oh, really? Okay.
In January, yes.
So they're very busy over in that area being citizens. Well, for most of us, it will be March the 4th, and we will have the Democratic as well as the Republican primary on the same date. You will usually return to your home precinct. Half of it will be Democratic, half of it will be Republican. We do not register as Republicans or Democrats in the state of Texas. So on Election Day, you can simply present yourself at the primary of your choice and vote. But what Deborah was alluding to is that evening at approximately 7:15, we ask all of our community to return to their precinct and to join in the precinct convention. There will be a precinct convention on March 4th. If you would like to be a delegate, if you'd like to take part in our party, it's a very important meeting, approximately lasting an hour or so. At that meeting, we will elect delegates to the Senate, to the state Senate convention, which will be held in March, as well as draft the first planks of the platform. And then again in March, we will convene for the state state Senate district, which there we will elect the delegates to the state convention, which will be held in Austin this year, this summer, and then on to Denver later in the summer. So it's very important that individuals know how to become a delegate.
Right. And in that precinct level, you can introduce resolutions.
Definitely.
And you can get them passed if you've organized your precinct, if you make sure you have like-minded people involved with you. And usually, if it comes out of a precinct, it'll go to the state level. I mean, it's pretty easy to get it. And that is what goes into shaping the platform. And it's amazing once you, it's like you realize you do have the power to do this. And I learned from Billy Carr.
Oh, she's great.
You know, so that's.
Right, a great legend.
And through what she taught, that's why Sue Lovell is on the Democratic National Committee. It's because we used this organized grassroots. She used to say, "Organize the bastards." What is it? Organize, don't. Okay, I can't
remember. We'll get it on our next show.
Her catchphrase, but she certainly was with the it was called Harris County Democrats, and it's the more liberal progressive wing of the party. And but yeah, it's like, as far as I'm concerned, I learned from the best that way of organizing a precinct, and also becoming a precinct judge.
Definitely.
You can conduct those caucuses. You can have some control there. You serve on the county steering committee for
the executive
party.
Committee.
So, once again, that's where your voice can go a little further.
And I think it's also important to talk about the fact that, you know, it's really important that we're going to be voting for a new president, but it's also very important to vote for all the other local races, judges, state reps, state senate, all those other, and there's going to be a long ballot this time.
It will. It'll be very long. As far as electing the president, that is important. One of the legacies, unfortunately, that will be left behind President George W. Bush will be his almost 300 nominations to the federal bench. These nominations for federal judges, they serve for life. And so depending upon, you know, the election, next election, it's incredibly important that we have a Democratic president who will be able to to sit the right people on the court.
Well, let's face it, we're going to be left with a great big old mess. And
definitely.
It's really going to take someone who can handle cleaning up that mess.
Right. We were talking about, and not to get too far off into Washington at the moment, that we need to realize that in this election, we will be electing our state legislature and our senator and senators and here in the legislature. And for us GLBT people, that's where the battleground has been for the last 12 years, where the conservative Republicans have been in charge, have been trying to steal our liberties on a daily basis. So when you go out to vote, you know, if you're not going to do a straight ticket, be sure you vote down ballot, because all politics are local and our lives are affected by those people who are elected locally.
Now, do you have to be gay to be a Stonewall Democrat?
No, certainly not. We are primarily GLBT, but everyone is welcome, and we just ask that, and we do have some members who are from the heterosexual community, our allies, and they are also members. And our club is having our third meeting tomorrow evening, December the 11th, at Ziggy's Healthy Grill, the location on Alabama Alabama at Greenbrier, and we invite everyone out at 6:30. It should be a great meeting, and already with our third meeting, we already have approximately 25 paid members and another 50 who are attending and or members. So we're growing fast, and we appreciate that.
That's good. Good. Congratulations.
Very good. Is there a regular set meeting night?
Yes, the second Tuesday of every evening. And
every month.
Exactly, the second Tuesday of every month. Thank you very much,
You're
Jennifer.
Welcome.
And we're always at Ziggy's Healthy Grill right there at Alabama
because
and Greenbrier.
Because we're healthy and we want to
be
healthy.
Yes, exactly.
That used to be Movable Feast.
And they're so good progressive individuals with their business, so we appreciate that. Also, we'll
good
have
people.
A holiday party this coming Saturday evening, December the 15th, from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Rice Hotel. You can go to our website, Houston Area Stonewall Democrats. com, and you'll be able to see an invitation as well as the information for the rest of the club.
What time is it from when to when?
Yes, it's from 7 o'clock until 10 o'clock at the Rice Hotel. It's located in the club room on the second floor, just adjacent to the really famous ballroom where so many important things have taken place. And we're so pleased to be there. It is donations are accepted, cash bar. Everyone's invited, and we hope that you'll be able to come out and join us.
Thank you so much for coming.
And that was Teresa Harrington with the Stonewall Democrats. Thank you for being with us on Queer Voices.
Be sure to join Queer Voices next week when we'll open up with Women's Poetry Jam with Donna Garrett, Shirley Bassey, and Saja. And making the holidays happy and gay. Jack Valensky talks with Sally Huffer from MCC about new queer ways to deal with the holidays. Queer holiday gift ideas and parties. What do we want in our stocking? Well, that and more with Ed Barnes and Nancy Ford, and of course our regular features, and all that and more next week on This Way Out from Queer Voices. You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Just completed our final on-air membership drive for 2007. This drive, KPFT listeners contributed over $325,000. If you were one of the many listeners who renewed or joined this drive, thank you very much. Before you know it, your membership envelope will arrive in the mail. Don't forget to pay your pledge. The great feeling you get when you support KPFT feels even better once you drop that check in the mail. And if you missed your chance to join and support the news, music, and other great programming you hear each day, there is still time. Join online at kpft.org to do your part or call 713-526-4000 extension 314 to become a member today. Thanks again for supporting community radio. This is commercial free, listener sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Earth Share of Texas makes it easy for you to protect the environment while supporting more than 70 leading environmental organizations through payroll contribution plans at public and private workplaces in Houston and across Texas. Help the environment while you work. One environment, one simple way to care for it. For more information, check out EarthShare-Texas.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.